come on the day of Ashura is whether he asked for water, asking for water from the enemy forces, especially in order to quench the thirst of his faithful companions and especially the children, because the family of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and Ahlul Bayt were over there in the tents. Is it so? If this is the case, is it at all good for an imam, for example, an infallible imam, to ask the other people, especially the enemy forces, for water?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The answer to this question is a matter of discussion even among today's contemporary scholars and researchers, and I will at least mention one of the reasons that why we have such differences of ideas. For example, in Arabic language, the word for asking for water is, one of them is istasqa.
Yes.
Now, istasqa can be translated into asking for water or searching for water.
Mm-hmm.
So in some narrations, this word has been used for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, that on the day of Ashura, he did istisqa. So what does it mean? Does it mean that he asked for water, which means that asking from the enemy, or he himself searched for water, like trying to go to the Euphrates, for example?
Yes.
So that is why we have some differences of ideas. This is one point. Before me going to the narration, let me share one point, and that is the fact that as you rightly mentioned, many people say that, okay, in Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the day of Ashura, in different occasions, he asked for water from the enemies. And
yes,
this is against the dignity of the Imam. It is a kind of humiliation,
yes,
before the enemy.
Okay.
And an Imam should not do that. Now, one point which should be taken into consideration is that we should think of different cultures in their time and era. So yes, maybe in our time and era, if you are in an, practical war and then ask for help from the enemy, it might be considered as a kind of humiliation. But was it the case in 61 after Hijra 2? Not necessarily. It might be that and it might not be that. That is a very, mm-hmm, important point that many, yes, of us, we ignore when we are reading the pages of the history. Let me share, for example, what Sheikh Allama Shushtari has mentioned in Khasa'is al-Husayniyah. He says that we see in the narrations that the Imam asked for water, but we never see that the Imam asked for food.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference? Imam was also hungry, during the day of Ashura too. He says that, of course, this is his explanation.
Yes.
I don't want to say that whether it is true or not, but this is a point to take into consideration. He says that in that time, in that culture, to ask for food was a kind of, a sign of humiliation before,
okay,
the enemy.
Yes.
And that is why Imam never did that. And that is why we see that when the caravan of Imam Hussein alayhi salam were going through the alleys of Kufa or,
yes,
Damascus, and people trying to give them food, we see that Lady Zainab salamu alayha and other people do not do that. They refrain from accepting food.
Yes.
So some people understand it based on fiqh or jurisprudence, but some people say that it was an act of humiliating the Ahlul Bayt.
We are not the beggars, we are,
exactly,
not in need of your charity.
That's the point.
Okay.
But this,
yes,
is not the case for water in that culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In that culture, to ask for water is okay.
Mm-hmm.
To accept water from,
yes,
other people, even the enemy, is okay.
Okay.
So that is one point that we should, when we are analyzing the history, we should not think about our criteria.
Yes.
We need to go back to that culture.
And because it was a battlefield, and we know that so many stations, several stations before reaching Karbala, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the enemy forces got to a point,
mm-hmm,
where Imam has now control over the water.
Exactly.
But he lets the branches of the water to be given to the enemy forces. And this is the point. Even it's been documented that Imam himself welcomes,
yeah,
one of the enemy forces, yeah, and the members with water.
When the army of Harb ibn Yazid Yahyi came to the Imam, not only the people of the enemy were given water by the Imam and his companions, even the animals,
the
horses.
That's right. Okay.
Now, going to the narrations, it seems that, I believe that according to different narrations, it seems that this is true, that in at least few cases, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam has asked for water.
Yes.
I will read some of these narrations and then I will go to the second part of the question. But the point is that, as I mentioned, it's not a matter of consensus among the Shia scholars. Okay. Some disagree with that, and I refer to one of the reasons. For example, Ibn Namah Hilli, who passed away in 645 after Hijra, he has a maqtal, a martyrdom account for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, titled Muthir al-Ahzan. He says that when the enemies, they tried to kill Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and his body was filled with spears and wounds, then the narrator says, وَهُوَ يَسْتَسْقِي شَرْبَةً مِنْ مَا وَلَا يَجِدْ. That is the word that I was talking about. Imam was doing istisqa, and he did not find any water. So whether istisqa means he was searching for water or he asked for water, this is a matter of dispute among the scholars. But some of the following narrations tell us that no, practically speaking, Imam asked the enemy for water. In another narration we read, عطش الحسين عليه السلام, Imam became very thirsty, فدعا بقدح من ما. Here we have فدعا, which means he asked for a glass of water. إن الحسين استسقى ماء حين قتل فمنع من وقتل وهو عطشان. Imam al-Husayn عليه السلام did استسقى before he becoming martyred, but they did not let him, and he was killed while he was thirsty. This sentence can be translated in two ways. Or for example, فَقَسَدَهُ الْقَوْمِ, people try to kill Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, وَهُوَ فِي ذَلِكَ يَطْلُبُ شَرْبَةً مِنَ الْمَا. Again, we have here searching for water or asking for water. Both of them can be possible.
That's all right.
جَعْلَ الْحُسَيْنِ يَطْلُبُ الْمَا. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was searching for water or for asking for water, and Shem was saying that do not let him to reach water.
That's all right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. And صاح الحسين بن علي اسقونا ماء. Now this sentence is very clear. So some of the previous sentences could be understood in two ways, that Imam searched for water or asked for water. But here the narration says Imam Hussein alayhi salam called out that isquna ma'an, give us some water. Farama rajulan bisahmin fashaqqa shatqa. Then a man shot an arrow toward Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which caused him a wound on his holy body.
Even Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas was in search of the water.
Exactly.
And when he got, for example, the water, and he was back, I mean, the bags of water were filled, he was martyred, you know, and his arms were cut off on the way back, you know,
exactly,
when getting the water.
So there are some other narrations, because of the time of the program, I'm not able to share all the narrations. For me, it seems that, I mean, having studied all these narrations, it seems that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in few cases at least, or at least in one case, he asked the enemy for water. Mm-hmm. But is it against the dignity of the Imam?
Sorry, before getting to the dignity, because the family with the Imam, so it is something natural to ask for the water for the children.
Exactly.
Or something like that, okay?
Exactly. Of course, again, there is a dispute in case of Ali ibn al-Asghar.
Yes.
Because some people believe that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam took him before the enemy just to ask the enemy to give him water.
Water, that's right.
For this case, it seems that we do not have an authentic narration for this case. The narrations are there that the Imam took the baby that is called Ali ibn al-Asghar, according to some narrations. He was in the arms of the Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, but it's not an authentic narration that in that case, in that occasion, Imam asked for water for that baby. It's not well authenticated.
That's right.
And of course, the rest of the story is true, that then an arrow was shot and Ali ibn Asghar was martyred.
Yes.
But whether Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked for water for that special case,
okay,
it is not according to an authentic narration.
That's all right.
But now,
is it against dignity of the Imam or
the
not?
The point is that no, it's not against the dignity of the Imam. At least there are three philosophies for that. Before going to these philosophies, I mean, as you rightly mentioned, at the end of the day, we are talking about human beings. I mean, mm-hmm. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because some people think that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was supernatural person, meaning that he didn't feel the thirst. No, Imam was suffering from that.
Yes.
All the companions, all the family members were suffering from that. Otherwise, there is no reward for that. So for sure, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was suffering, his family members were suffering, and it's very natural in this case to ask for water, yes, if this is not an act of showing humiliation.
Up to an extent, they were thirsty. I think it is documented that Imam al-Hussein puts his ring on the tongue of Ali al-Akbar,
according
isn't it?
Some notions, yeah.
Yeah, to quench the thirst, exactly, of Ali al-Akbar, and says, father and son, you know, how thirsty you are, quench your thirst with the ring stone.
Exactly, a miracle done by the Imam, according to some narrations.
Yes.
So one, there's three philosophers. One point is that it is a kind of, completing the hujjah, the proof against the enemy.
Yes.
The point is that because some people later could say that, or on the Day of Judgment might say that Imam did not ask us for any help,
mm-hmm,
because the same question is asked, why did the Imam ask for help?
Yes.
We have it in many stations that the Imam asked some people to join his caravan. What was the reason? Is it against the dignity of the Imam? No. Imam wanted to complete the argument, because otherwise the people later could say that the Imam did not ask for any help or for water. Otherwise, we would have helped the Imam or would have given, yes, him water. So this is one point. The second point is that this is a kind of, this is an act of Imam to make the tragedy of Karbala an immortal event.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked about this point, that this is a very special event in the whole history of mankind. And the fact that the Imam is asking for water, but he's not given any water, it, yes, is, one of the sad pages of the tragedy, yes, of Karbala.
Yes.
So this is another, might be another philosophy why Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked for water. And the third point, which is very considerable, is the fact that Imam alayhi salam is the manifestation of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
There is no doubt about that. And we see and we read in the narrations that till the last moment of his life, Imam was thinking of the fate and destiny of the enemies too.
Yes.
And he was giving advice to the people.
Guiding the people to the right path. That's right.
So according to some scholars, one of the reasons for this istisqa was that maybe Imam alayhi salam found it a way to, yes, guide some people.
Yes.
When Imam is asking for water, at least it was likely for some people just, yes, to be touched, just to be touched, that, yes, this is the son of the Prophet. He is asking us for even water, and we are not giving him water.
To make them conscious of the...
Exactly. And that might be a way for some people to at least be away from the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, which,
right,
happened,
which happened,
I mean, practically,
right,
speaking. Yes, yes. Although not many people joined the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we have the case of Hur ibn Yazid al-Yahya, yes, and a few other people who joined the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam from the army of the enemy army. But we have other people who did not join the Imam, but they left the army of Umar ibn Sa'd. This,
okay,
is, according to the, yes, many historical reports. So the third philosophy that may think of is that at least we may think of it as a possible philosophy. Imam did that so that it might be, a way for some people to,
yes,
change their destiny, their fate, to join the Imam, or at least to,
yes,
be away from the army of the Umar ibn Sa'd.
And showing the true face of the enemy, I mean, the Yazid,
mm-hmm,
as the ruler. All Muslims, look who is the ruler of the Muslims, such deviated,
exactly,
people, who is, you know, that's all right. really, really sad story. And these aspects of this story, the tragedy of Karbala has been reiterated and remembered to see that how the enemies of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad did cruelty and atrocity, not only towards him and his companions, but his family members, the women, and the children. Thank you much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration regarding Istighasa. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the grey green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day, since the menu largely includes local flavors.
visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
Many people develop deeper relationship with four-legged animals, treating them like their own kids. A Kenyan conservationist is one of them. 33-year-old Salome Lemercier has been a community ranger in Sierra Conservancy, northern Kenya, since 2015. The mother of four is stationed at a rhino sanctuary and is in charge of protecting a male rhino named Loijipo. At just a few days old, Loijipo was abandoned by his mother, possibly due to her being spooked by something. After being cared for, he was returned to the sanctuary under surveillance in an attempt to rewild him. 3 years on, from his release into Sierra Wilderness, he is taking his time to carve out his territory, of course, with the help of Salome. The chest fever in the southern Indian city of Chennai is on a peak as the 44th International Chess Olympiad kicks off there. Students created a mammoth chessboard on the playground and dressed up as 32 chess pieces to promote the game. For 2 weeks, Chennai is hosting nearly 2,000 players from 188 countries. For the first time in nearly 100 years of history, the Chess Olympiad, India is playing host. The event will run until August 10th. Ahead of the game, 150 underprivileged children from various government schools were given the opportunity to fly. These were the students who won in a district-level chess tournament. Excited spectators gather at the Solberg Airport in the U.S. for the 39th New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning.
We have about 45 balloons here today, including these spectacular special shapes. Our signature New Jersey Lottery Sunny Days balloon. You can see the tiger. Unicorn is hiding behind there. Tasmanian Devil, unique photo panda. We are having a spaceship. There's Billy the Kid. Spectacular presentation. You won't believe your skies this weekend.
Dozens of hot air balloons were test inflated in preparation for the real deal. The festival is considered the largest summertime event in New Jersey. Reddington City officials have predicted about 170,000 people will join the festival over the weekend. Weather forecasts say the sky are gentle enough for over 100 balloons to take flight in the morning and evening in mass ascents. And no one is more excited than the festival producer, who has been planning the event for months.
Including these spectacular special shapes, the balloons bring out the kid in everyone. You know, I've done this for a long time. This is the 39th annual one. But still, when I hear that propane whirring and these balloons going up, it makes the hair on my arm stand up.
The producer says these balloons will be handled by professional pilots and other balloons will be available for rides. The festival will last for 3 days, ending with food vendors games, amusement rides, and other entertainment. There will also be a massive fireworks display, as well as a nighttime feature of glowing balloons. The annual festival is the largest seasonal hot air balloon festival in North America. It draws in thousands of visitors every year.
You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces, and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zeroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America. Would you buy a pair of scrap tire sandals? Well, in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, you will find all kinds of handmade sandals from recycled tires. The famously rugged footwear of the Viet Cong have traveled vast distances over the decades. Shoemakers use sharp knives and chisels to craft a sandal from huge tires. For those seeking a nod to yesteryear, the hard-sole sandals are available at markets and small stores alike, with prices ranging from $2,000 to $1,000. The Vietnamese first began making rubber sandals in the late 1940s during the first Indochina War against the French, using tires from ambushed army trucks. They found the sandals were cheap to make and survive well in wet, muddy, and hilly conditions. Even in peacetime, the design remains popular for sustainability reasons. Living through a pandemic is strange as we are often locked indoors, but a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an airplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues. But he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to 4 people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across 4 European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of 4. Some gardens are decorated with genomes and other cute ornaments, but this garden uses tank debris to stand out amongst others. The intention of the gardener isn't to have the most army-themed patch. Valeria tried to remove the tank, but ultimately, because of its size and weight, it was impossible. So he just let it stay. The owner says he is used to having the tank there, even though it reminds him of hard times. Next to the wreckage, this family has planted cabbage and potatoes, which they harvest and use each year. The tank was left over from the war between Russia and Ukraine that began earlier this year.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear listeners, my very dear sisters and brothers from all around the world, welcome to another episode of Youth Station. Here we are once more. This is Asma. And with me, I have my very dear friend Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. How are you, Zainab?
Alhamdulillah, I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, dear listeners, today we're going to talk about the thing which is very much common between all the human beings, which
is crying.
Are you a crying person, Zainab?
Well, what if I tell you we are always constantly in a state of crying? First, we have to understand what is that. Like tears.
Mm-hmm.
Our eyes are producing tears constantly.
That's salty water.
Yeah, that's, I guess, some half a teaspoon in a day. Our eyes produce that. And yes, as you rightly said, it's just water. Most of it is water.
Mm-hmm.
But it has some percent of salt. It has some percent of chemicals.
And so much of emotions.
Not always.
Most of the time.
I'll tell you where.
Mm-hmm. But so you have done a research upon tears.
I have read this topic so much because, you know, when Muharram comes in and we see these tearful eyes, tearful people, and then coming out from those gatherings as a least distressed person, it has compelled me to go for a research for a number of times. So I have, yes, definitely done a lot of
We're going to make use of whatever you have gone through then.
Yes. So I was saying, first of all, we have tears.
Yeah.
Tears are, most of the percent is water, and then some percent is salt, and some percent are chemicals, and there are some enzymes which are there to protect you from germs.
Yeah.
So you constantly have tears in your eyes because of the tear glands. Mm-hmm. And you produce some half a teaspoon of tears in a day just to keep your eyes, you know, you have
the water that keeps your eyeballs healthy.
And interestingly, Asma, it's not just water. When I was just researching on this for some long time ago, I found that it's not just water. It's some percent of oil as well.
Yes, yes, I've been through that as well.
To keep that, you know, moistness.
And it was very interesting.
Yeah.
Oil.
Otherwise, your eyes will dry up.
Yeah.
The tears will evaporate.
So there's a poem that says, "Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean. Tears from the depth of some divine despair that gathers in the heart and rises to the eyes."
Wow.
So that is what I know about tears.
Oh, well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Now these are the normal tears we always
but
have.
But mostly the kind of tears that we as human beings are facing are just these kind of idle tears.
Yeah, which flow from your eyes.
Yes, and they are full of emotions.
You know, we basically have a drainage system for the flowing of tears.
Yeah.
And that's through nose. You might have experienced.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
when you're crying, mm-hmm. you have a running nose.
Yeah.
Because that's the actual draining system.
Let's put that physical part aside and come to the point that why do we cry?
We cry because of... You mean to say why do we have this overflow of tears that comes out of our eyes?
Yeah.
We have that because of
why suddenly you sit in a place and you remember something sad or something very happy, and then suddenly you feel like your eyes are getting watery.
You put it there, you know. You said, why do we cry? We cry at some situations. Mm-hmm. Either you're very sad.
Yeah.
Or you're very happy.
You're very happy.
Or some dust has just entered your eyes.
Yeah.
Or you're cutting onions.
Yes. So,
well, the most of the thing that we deal with is the sad and emotional tears.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we see most of the times. I mean, we never say like we are always in a state of crying.
Yeah.
And when you're emotional, you kind of per minute release some half a cup of water, half a cup of tears
mm-hmm.
from your eyes. But when you're emotional, hundreds of research have been done which say that the chemicals released with these emotional and sad tears mm-hmm. were quite different than the normal tears.
Yeah.
Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah, Allah, walhamdulillah, Allah, Allah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Allah, Allah, walhamdulillah, ya Allah.
You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear listeners, you were listening to Youth Station. We were talking about crying and do not cry upon trivial things. Tears help you, even if they
because
are
you're
tears
releasing
of
stress.
Sadness. Yeah.
The chemicals that you release right now with the stress hormones,
mm-hmm.
most of them, 90% of this is the stress hormones, especially when you're emotional. And where do we see that, Asma?
Mm.
We see that in these gatherings of Muharram.
Yeah, that is very true, yes.
And that's why I think we feel that.
And they are the sort of very special teardrops because, as just you mentioned it earlier, when you come out of those morning sessions, you do not feel like you're depressed or you have cried your eyes out. It just feels like you feel lighter.
Because
like
you have drained out all the stress hormones out of mm-hmm. your body.
I guess that is because those tears are very special and they have rewards behind them.
Yeah. As you need to excrete
mm-hmm.
extra salt, extra water from your body through sweating and other excretory processes, you need mm-hmm. to excrete the stress out of your body.
Do we have idle tears, Zainab? Tears that have got no values in them?
Yes, crocodile tears. We do have. That's something related to your brain. Like you signal your brain something.
Mm-hmm.
Your heart signals your brain something and start crying over very non-serious things or like maybe to please someone or to show off and all. That's why they are called.
And sometimes over something very trivial or very little, you cry. That's why we have been recommended in our narrations to whenever we feel crying, we must cry for the sorrows of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Because those tears are going to be rewarded.
Yeah.
And they are valuable tears. They're not just idle tears. You sit in a corner and you do that, you cry your eyes out, and there's nothing out of it.
You basically are going to extinguish the hellfire with those 3 years. That's true.
So, okay, guys. So we come to this point that tears are necessary. These are the part of our living thing. So as we are living beings, we have to cry, and it happens most of the times. But sometimes crying for worldly things, for trivial things, is not the rightest thing to do. Yes, it do release the emotion that you have, but you should consider that These tears must have a value. So whenever you're going to cry, as we have been recommended, we have to cry for something valuable.
Yeah,
just as I told you.
Yeah.
There was a scholar who used to cry in those mourning sessions for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So he asked his family to keep that handkerchief that he used to dry out his tears in order to be the witness of whatever he has done in this world, whatever teardrops he have gathered in that handkerchief, in order to witness for
because
him.
He knew that those tears were valuable.
Yeah, and those tears are going to be the witness in the world to come.
Yes, because on that day when we will be shocked, we will be in a state of shock. We won't be able to talk.
Yeah,
everything around us will be
and
talking.
Also, we should consider
the earth
that
will be witness, our
these
tears will
teardrops
be witness.
Are very special. Just as I told you, we have narrations that says how valuable these tears are. We do think that these tears are not just something worldly, just a salty water that comes out of your eyes. These tears contain so much of words inside of them.
Yeah, you know, actually, a believer is wise. It's in Quran, a believer is always wise, choosy, clever. So whenever you, like you as a female, are cooking something at home, you make so many efforts into it.
Yeah.
But with just one intention, you can change that mubah thing, that something that had no value, that was neutral, into a recommended thing, into a mustahab and recommended thing, with just changing the intention while you're cooking.
So it's all about intentions.
It's all about intentions. Like when you're even as you said, you are feeling depressed, you want to cry, just cry in the name of Ahlul Bayt, be wise, turn this idle thing into a recommended mustahab.
So we shouldn't let these teardrops
as
be a
believer,
sign of
you
weakness.
Have to be wise. You have to be wise in every state of your life. You have you can change just level of your actions from neutral level to a recommended level just with the change of intention.
Exactly. Yeah. So these cries are not the sign of weakness. These are actually the sign of strength and power, and one day these are going to be helping us.
Witness.
Yeah, as the witness, they would come
and not
to
just these tears, the earth, the place, the country you were staying in.
Every single thing you have touched.
It will speak on that day that this person at this particular time was staying on me, walking on me, and that time he was crying for Ahlul Bayt. So or what better than this?
Exactly.
And we are in need of such kind of witness on
of
that day.
Of course, yeah. Instead of crying, as I told you, instead of crying for our miseries, we cry for a greater cause that is going to stand for us someday.
Yes.
Nobody can tell you, do not cry. It's a permission that God has given you to release your emotions through the channels of your eyes and to cry your eyes out how much you like. But try to do it upon something that is so much great, and do it in a way that is going to be a witness for you. And someday these tears would talk for you, and they would be a help for you. So also, Zainab, we already know about the energy that everything contains, right?
Yeah.
Even those teardrops might have special energies.
They do have.
We talked about it already. It was about the intention.
Yeah. Professor Emoto, a Japanese researcher, did a research on water.
Yeah.
And he would call water with different names, and he did tremendous research, and then he would find that whatever he would say, the water would attain shapes, the same shapes. You know, water, even if you put physically water in some vessel, it again attains the same shape.
Yeah.
In the same way, human body, more than 70% of it contains of water. So when you're draining that out emotionally, it is attaining shapes.
Yeah.
It is attaining those beautiful spiritual shapes rather than draining your energy, it is providing you energy.
Yeah.
But when it's emotional.
So what you actually are trying to say is that the intention that you have would give those teardrops a sort of a special energies, and they would take different shapes.
Yeah.
So the shape of those tears would be different, of course, when you cry for something that has got a great cause.
Yeah.
Than when you are doing that for a special thing, for something that you didn't get or achieve. So, dear listeners, since we are in the month of Muharram, whenever you have that gathered tears in your eyes, please, please do not forget us from your prayers. And I hope you had enjoyed this session. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are focusing on the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam lays down the strategy behind him taking over this governance and this important role of leading the Muslim Ummah. And we discussed that one of those things that he's going to do is that he's going to allow the Muslim Ummah to come back to a state where everyone who deserves truly an opportunity to progress, to go ahead, he will definitely be given that opportunity. This is the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And then later on he goes on to say, أَلَا وَإِنَّ الْخَطَايَا خَيْلٌ شُمُسٌ حُمِلَ عَلَيْهَا أَهْلُهَا وَخُلِعَتْ لُجُمُهَا فَتَقَحَّمَتْ بِهِمْ فِي النَّارِ. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, look, the problem with the Muslim Ummah today is the fact that they have held on to some mistakes, some wrongdoings, and they don't want to leave those. They want to tightly hold on to them, and that is going to cause them destruction.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about this statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, "Ala wa innal khataya khaylun shumusun," that, O people, that beware, that certainly mistakes, wrongdoings are like horses, but that's not normal horses. These are wild horses, which are made to carry their people. The people who climb those horses, who make those mistakes and want to stick to those mistakes. وَخُلِعَتْ لُجُمُهَا while the reins of the horses are removed. So Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving an example here. He is drawing a parable that if a community decides to continue with its mistakes, does not want to leave those mistakes, they know that mistakes are such that they carry that person, that community that wants to continue to live in the mistaken manner, in the wrongful manner, it carries them. But then this horse is wild, and at the same time, it doesn't have any reins. And because it doesn't have any reins, you cannot control it. And because it is wild, this horse, you can imagine, it can take you and throw you into a valley. This horse can take you and just bang you on some rocks. This horse can, you know, overturn and crush you. It can do whatever it wants because it is wild. You don't have any reins to control it. And that is the reality of mistakes. That is the reality of wrongs, of holding on to wrong policies. When you know that you have made a wrong policy in the society, a mistaken policy, then know that if you're continuing to bow down to that wrong policy, to that mistaken policy, then it's like going to take you and destroy you. Look at the world today, and you will see those governments that instated wrong policies. Look at them. Those wrong policies are destroying them. They are causing destruction. They are causing havoc. And those communities are getting destroyed. And you can see this happening in front of you. Because it's a wild horse that has no reins, that is going to take you wherever it wants. It could be drown you somewhere, can destroy you, can, you know, just do whatever it wants. That is the reality. Look at the beautiful example Imam Ali alayhi salam gives you here. It is truly a miracle, the way he spoke and what he said. This is a beautiful, beautiful example of how communities continue to hold on to their mistakes and what those mistakes can do to them, what those false and wrong and erroneous policies can do to those communities.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam here beautifully gives an example and says that those communities that continue to hold on to false and wrong policies, they are like climbing on horses. They are like made to sit on horses that are really, you know, they are wild and they cannot be controlled. And therefore they will destroy you. And that's why he says, فَتَقَحَّمَتْ بِهِمْ فِي النَّارِ. Such horses, these holding on to these mistakes, holding on to these false policies, you know, making policy after policy based on a wrong foundation. All of these that you do are pulling you down, because these horses, they are such that they are going to make you drown into the fire. They're going to make you drown in the fire of disunity, the fire of the corruption, the fire of disruption. And this is the reality. Look at, for example, the policies that are happening in the world today, whereby a few privileged people, whereby a few privileged people are given the opportunity to have capital, to grow in their businesses, to do what they want, while the few that probably have the potential but are not given the opportunity. Look at this. Look at the 99% and 1% that we see in America, for example. What has that policy led to? Holding on to that policy means that you are going to drown the economy. And right now, those people do not want to leave those false and wretched policies. And therefore, be sure that they are going to be taken down by those same policies. So in other words, those false policies, those wrongdoings, if you continue to get hold of them, if you do not change, if you do not make a transformation, if you do not accept that those who are wrong and do not take that responsibility to change, then it's going to take you down with it. And that is the warning that Imam alayhi salam gives in the form of a beautiful example. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the emergence of a new quadrilateral grouping, including India, Israel, UAE, and the U.S., and how New Delhi has very little to gain from it. And we shall also take a look at the annual Muharram commemorations in Hindu-majority India, the traditions, the history, and why Muslims are treading cautiously now.
A new quadrilateral group, abbreviated as I2U2, has recently announced its arrival on the global stage, bringing together India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. The inaugural meeting of the group, which was conceptualized in October last year, took place virtually last month during US President Joe Biden's West Asia tour. Dubbed the West Asia Quad, I2U2 is seen as a fresh attempt by the US to rally friends and allies to contain China's growing influence.
The emergence of the I2U2 group amid rapidly changing geopolitical dynamics has created a buzz in the region's intelligentsia circles. The group's stated objectives point to six mutually identified areas, including water, energy, transportation, space, health, and food security. But there's more to it than meets the eye. According to India's foreign ministry, the quadrilateral group was conceptualized on October 18 last year during the meeting of the foreign ministries of the four countries, India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. Ahead of the group's first virtual summit last month, a former Israeli national security advisor described the formation of I2U2 as a significant development and India's participation in it as a game changer. Regional observers believe the group seeks to integrate the West Asian region with Indo-Pacific, built on the so-called Abraham Accords that saw many Arab regimes normalizing their ties with the Israeli regime and resist growing Chinese influence in the region. While India's traditional rivalry with China and growing proximity to the